Welcome, Gladys, to another LNL on RN Summer. Today's Cornucopia includes a chat with Sarah Churchwell, a fine writer and communicator, about her favourite topic and one of mine, Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby. But first of all, let me take you back in time about 3,000 years to the moment in history when the Oracle of Delphi was being consulted by kings and leaders and warriors to divine their future. By the 8th century, Delphi had already been known for 1,000 years as the navel. That's the one in the tummy, not the one with ships bobbing around on the ocean. The navel, or the centre of the ancient world, and people flocked there to receive direction from the oracle and to set up monuments to the gods in gold, ivory, bronze, marble, oh, and to participate in music festivals and athletic competitions said to rival those at Olympia. For a small remote city, Delphi punched well above its weight, but like many a great city, it would in due course fade into obscurity. Dr. Michael Scott, Assistant Professor of Classics and Ancient History at the University of Warwick and the author of Delphi, A History of the Centre of the Ancient World, and he joined me from that university studios. Now, Delphi is situated precariously on the side of a steep hill, so I asked him to begin by describing the physicality of the area.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of the things that really strikes you when you visit there as a tourist today. You're swept up the roads, and even so, you can't get a sense of Delphi. You don't get to see it until the very last turn around the last crag of the Parnassian Mountains where it's set, until you make that final turn, and then it's suddenly revealed in all its glory to you. And I think we have to imagine that as being the way the ancients came upon it as well. If they had journeyed all the way up from the seaport of Itea, about 600 meters below Delphi, or they traveled over the roads through the center of Greece and up to Delphi, they too would have been, spared that vision of what Delphi was until the very final moment. It really wouldn't have been a place that you approached slowly and it gradually came onto your horizon. Delphi would have been a place that smacked you in the face when you came round the corner to it. And I think that would have really kind of doubled its impact. You imagine all that gold, ivory, silver, marble glistening in the beautiful Greek sunshine suddenly appearing to you. Really a marvel to behold.
Tell us about a powerful vapor that arose in its vicinity.
Well, here are the stories. The stories are multiple, and they start from the ancient world itself. In fact, one of the questions that the ancient Greeks and indeed Roman authors were constantly asking was, how does Delphi work? How does the oracle work? And indeed, the earliest explanations we have don't talk about a vapor at all. It's interesting that it's not really until we get into the first century BC, that crossover point between the Greek world and the Roman world, that the first mention of vapor, and the Greek word is pneuma, starts to appear in the sources. And it's a very odd one. It's thanks to a writer called Diodorus, who talks about the shepherds who used to have their goats feeding on the side of the mountain. They suddenly noticed that these goats, when they went near a particular part of the ground, went a bit doolally and started doing weird things. And any shepherds who wandered near this particular point in the ground, they went a bit doolally and started doing weird things. And so Diodorus tells the story that to stop any more goats falling in and shepherds going doolally, they established some poor woman sat in a three-legged stool over the top of this hole in the ground to make sure that no one else suffered the same fate. And this was the beginning of the oracle. And these stories about these vapors really start to build off the first century BC. What that vapor was, there's an entirely different set of questions.
Now, the oracle delivered the words of the god Apollo, but the message came via priestesses. How many?
Well, again, this is another of the complications. We do not have a single ancient source that tells us clearly, explicitly, from beginning to end, how a consultation of this famous oracle at Delphi took place. So what we have to do is piece together lots of fragments of different parts and bits of the consultation process and try and get a sense of a picture, which we know must have changed over time. And the very moment when the consultant with their question gave their question to the priestess of the god Apollo at Delphi, who sat on this tripod, who was supposed to breathe in these vapors, be inspired by the god, and then give a response, that moment is probably the most opaque of all. We don't know, for instance, for certain, whether or not the consultant stood directly in front of this priestess, saw her breathe in these vapors, and heard his response directly, or whether he was in a separate room and he gave his question to somebody else, perhaps these sort of priest attendants around this Pythian priestess, who asked the question, took a response, wrote it down, and then delivered it to the consultant.
I'm talking to Michael Scott, and Michael, I corrected myself when I was introducing you. I was about to say, you got your writing instructions there, but that's not what you got, because, yes, advice, but often in the forms of riddles or poetic prose. It wasn't that didactic.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not, in the UK here, we were used to the Mystic Meg on the lottery program of an evening who would sit there and give sort of thoughts about what the future would be like. That's not the Oracle at Delphi. It is not a fortune teller in the sense that we might be used to today. People came with questions that were, would it be better for me to do X or Y? So you offered two options, and the priestess would respond, often was saying, you know, do X or Y, but often even it wouldn't be as clear as that. It would be some kind of riddle, as he said. Take a famous example. King Croesus of Lydia turned up to the oracle and said, you know, would it be better for me to go to war or not go to war? And the answer came back, if you go to war, a great empire will fall. Now, Croesus happily went away going, great, that means I should go to war and I'm going to win. But he ended up losing, and he came back afterwards to the oracle to complain about the you know, what he'd got from the oracle, saying it was unclear. And at that point, the oracle turned around to him and went, no, you misinterpreted it. I said, if you go to war, a great empire will fall. I didn't say whether it was going to be yours or your enemy's.
I'm reminded of Tony Blair when we discussed this. He needed to think through the prophecies about a more recent conflict.
Well, but, yeah, I mean, he got known as Teflon Tony, didn't he, for his ability to escape from having the blame securely fixed on him. And in many ways, people do talk about the Oracle at Delphi as having a kind of Teflon coating, a resistance to being found to be wrong, for two reasons. If you're asking the question, would it be better for me to do X or Y, and the oracle tells you to do X, and you go away and you do X, and it turns out to be horrible, you come back and you go, why did you tell me to do X? And the oracle simply has to go, well, you don't know how bad Y would have been.
Michael, many years ago, I was involved in a television show about Nostradamus, and of course, his quatrains were very, very cleverly ambiguous. You could draw from them what you wanted. It's probably the best way to give advice.
Yes, I mean, I think the oracle, someone once said to me, oh, right, you know, this oracle at Delphi sounds much more like a management consultant. And in some ways, that's very true. You pay your fee to go to talk to someone you've got with your problem. You get some advice, which you have to take away and think about some more, and think about how you want to interpret, and think about what you as a result want to decide to do, and then you go about and do it. There's a very famous quote, an ancient source about the Oracle of Delphi, which says it doesn't reveal, it indicates. And that's the sense that we need to think about it in.
And you make the point that it was best to ask questions in a somewhat ambiguous way, not simply, well, you've instanced this way or that, but it was often quite important to be charmingly oblique in your approach.
Yes, although some people didn't get that message. I mean, there are famous examples like Alexander the Great, who turned up at Delphi, and he was obviously on a mission to head off and conquer most of the Persian Empire, everything to the east, modern-day Turkey. And he didn't want to wait for one of the specific days. There was only one day each month for 9 months of the year when the oracle was allowed to give pronouncements.
And he didn't want to wait for that. So he sort of grabbed this poor priestess, dragged her into the temple. She sort of went, oh, you're so invincible. And, and he went, great, fine. That sounds wonderful. I'll take that and I'll head off on my merry way. So sometimes people didn't get the message of subtlety.
Well, one of them who didn't get the message was Emperor Nero. Tell us about, he didn't like the message he got.
Well, it's a slightly more complicated story, sadly, and it's to do, again, if you think about the examples of modern politics, of what we call damnatio memoriae, of changing the story after somebody has done something wrong to make it look like he was always in the wrong. And Nero suffered a lot of this in the ancient world. So there are different sources that talk about his journeys to Delphi. He was a lover of all things Greek. He went to Greece. He competed in the Olympic Games. He visited Delphi and he made a point.
He not only competed, he won.
Yeah, he won everything. Surprise, surprise. Yes, I think they even had to invent an extra competition just for him to excel in a couple of different things. So the early sources talk about him going to Delphi and being fairly respectful on the one hand, consulting the oracle, being a good tourist. On the other hand, he decided that he liked so much of the stuff at Delphi that he took about 500 statues back home to have put up in his golden house in Rome. But later on, when the world, if you like, the ancient world, turned against Nero and wanted to make out that every one of his actions had been horrific, the stories start to emerge that the Delphic Oracle had actually been a lot more lippy with him than otherwise had been thought, and accused him of being a murderer of his mother, the rumours of which were circulating in Rome at the time, to which Nero is said to have responded savagely by sort of bricking up the entrance to the temple and leaving this poor priestess to starve to death inside.
Or to choke on her vapours.
Yes, quite possibly. What I think is fascinating about studying Delphi, and which I think hopefully comes through very clear in the book, is that history, and particularly ancient history, is not simply a series of events of facts, of truths, or as 1066 and all that, one thing after another. It's actually a series of contested moments that are represented and rewritten and retold to have a different use within the present, the evolving present.
I feel that I'm getting the vapors tonight because of your energies, Michael, and let me remind the listener that you are Dr. Michael Scott, Assistant Prof in the Department of Classics and Ancient History at Warwick, and we're discussing your book, Delphi, A History of the Centre of the Ancient World, published by Princeton. Was the integrity of the priestesses regularly or occasionally challenged?
In some ways, yes, but I think it's very instructive that in the entirety of the ancient world, in the 1,000 years or so that we know the oracle at Delphi to have been functioning, there is not a single story that actively tells us that her advice was completely ignored.
And that, is that right?
I think that's an absolutely extraordinary thing. There are, on the other hand, stories when the oracle seems to have been bribed. Particularly this priestess, who was normally a young girl, about 18 or so, may have been bribed to give a particular response. And what the reaction is at that stage is simply to get rid of the girl and replace her with another one. Mm. So the elements, if you like, the cogs in the system occasionally are found to be faulty, but the system itself is never doubted.
Were there rituals involving the sexuality of the priestesses? Was it necessary for them, for example, to be virgins?
Well, again, two different stories. On the one hand, the early priestesses seem to all have been 18-year-old maidens, as you say, virgins or young women untainted by real life. But because of these problems with bribery, and because the Greeks sort of saw these bribery cases coming up as a result of these young women being extremely impressionable, they then switched it and actually had older women in their 45, 50-year-olds taking on the role, although they tended to dress them up in young girls' clothing even so. So they tried to sort of retaliate, if you like, against these accusations of bribery by putting much more mature, sensible women who wouldn't be led astray in the role. The other side of the coin, though, this image of an overtly sort of sexualized priestess is actually one that's created for us by the early Christian sources. When Christianity comes into play in the 4th century AD and afterwards, it has a huge job to try and convince what is a very much a largely pagan world. And one of the ways they do this is the early Christian writers do try to make out that some of the most famous, brightest stars in the pagan world are actually very bad. And one of those that they attack is the Delphic Oracle. And you get this picture of the Oracle being turned into this overtly sort of sexualized mystic creature, more like a witch in our terms. And you can see that actually in paintings of the Delphic Oracle as well, that some of the earliest representations make her out to be a very normal looking woman. Look at some of the 18th and 19th century portraits of her, and she's a nude Medusa sexualized figure that's trying to take men off the proper course and send them off and down some wicked path.
I mentioned Nostradamus in passing, and we should make the point that he was one of a great number of people competing in the profession of, you know, belting out interesting quatrains, and that is also the case with oracles at the time. The Delphic Oracle had to fight for market share, in effect.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think terms like market share, you know, really have some place. If you look at a map of Greece, there were thousands, literally thousands of locations in which the Greeks and the Romans and everyone else living around the Mediterranean could go to consult an oracle. And you sometimes even you didn't have to leave your home. You could simply look at the flight of birds or the ripples on a pond.
Did oracles do home visits as well, perhaps?
Well, at Olympia, much more famous for the Olympic Games, they too had an oracular family that was itinerant, i.e. it would go away and travel to you, particularly to commanders on military campaigns, and would send someone there who would then slaughter an animal, look at its liver, and read the entrails. So there were a myriad of ways in which you could find out about what the gods had in store, and Delphi had to fight for its place. And there are two really interesting stories of how it does that. One is it changes its own story about where it comes from to make it seem a more ancient and thus more important oracle. So the stories about where Delphi originated from keep getting rolled back in time until basically Delphi was there at the very beginnings of everything, before anything else. And on the other hand, you also see particular consultants who very cleverly manipulate the system to get what they want. There's a Spartan king who wants a particular oracular response to help kickstart a plan of his. Now, he wants an oracular response that has got real authority, so he needs it to come from Delphi. But what he does first is he goes to a little local oracular sanctuary that actually is an oracle of the god Zeus, the king of the gods, the father of Apollo, who was present at Delphi. And this little oracular sanctuary he has a lot more control over. So he gets the oracle of Zeus at this tiny little sanctuary to give him the response he wants. Fantastic. But then he goes to Delphi, and all he asks at Delphi to Apollo is, does the son agree with his father? Now, Apollo cannot disagree with his father, the king of the gods. So he has to say, yes, I agree with my father. So this Spartan king was able to walk away with the response he wanted, with the authority of Delphi as well. Brilliantly manipulating the system.
That's just great stuff, Michael. Now, let's get technical. I understand that geological tests have been done to test the vapors and indeed the water beneath the oracular site of Delphi. What was found?
Yeah, I mean, this has been the big mystery, if you like, of the 20th century. When the excavators first dug up Delphi, they were sure they were going to find this big hole in the ground underneath the temple from which these vapors emerged, and they didn't. And the bitterness in their voices when you read the reports and publications, they really do feel like the ancient world was lying to them. You know, how dare they lie to us? And it's been that way for most of the 20th century. But then in the late 90s, two geologists, John Hale and Jolly de Boer, came together and started doing some more investigations of the area. And what they showed was there is a very active seismic fault line that runs along the back of where Delphi is. But actually, interestingly, underneath the temple, indeed exactly underneath the temple, two smaller crack lines, if you like, exist deep underground. Now, because of the big seismic fault line moving, these cracks get agitated, gases start to be released, and because of the particular nature of the stone underneath Delphi, it's called bituminous limestone, that allows for these gases to get up towards the surface. And what they did was they tested the water on the surface at Delphi, but they also tested the stone on the surface at Delphi, and particularly travertine, which is a stone that only really forms when you have gases and water mixing along with the native rock. And they found quantities of gases like ethylene. Now, ethylene was used as an...
as an anesthetic.
Yeah,
or for anesthesia, yeah.
And also to sort of... It was used in a lot of psychological experiments in the United States in the 1920s. And it does send people on a high, basically, sort of sending them on a journey. So what they showed was that it is technically possible in an enclosed environment like the Temple of Apollo would have been at Delphi, in a small little bit of it at the back of the temple where this priestess would have stood, potentially for these gases to build up in significant enough amounts to have an hallucinogenic effect on her.
I'd love to get this organised for the studio. It would it would improve, you know, very often the guests aren't as entertaining as you, Michael. Sometimes they're hard work. And a little bit of these gases just quietly percolating around the studio could work wonders. At the height of Delphi's influence and power, what was the population, do we know?
Oh, well, this is the, I think for me, the most extraordinary thing. Delphi was not just a temple of Apollo or a sanctuary of Apollo. It was also a small city that surrounded the sanctuary. But in its entirety of its lifetime, in the 1,000 years that it was the real center of the ancient world, the population of Delphi was probably never more than 1,000 people.
And that how could that be?
Well, it was a tiny community living, clinging to the mountainsides. It's not a hospitable environment. Indeed, some of the earliest stories that talk about the origins of Delphi, when they claim that the god Apollo was pottering around looking for a site for an oracle, and he decided that Delphi was the place for him, and he drags a bunch of Cretan fishermen sort of from their fishing boat up to become his first priest, and they complain to him, and they say, why have you put us here? You know, we'd never survive. There's nothing here. And he says, no, don't worry, people are going to come from all over the world to you. You're not going to worry about anything. And that was absolutely the truth. I mean, Delphi is an extraordinarily difficult place to live. And as a result, these Delphians, these 1,000 or so citizens of this little town, were their fortune, their future, their survival was intimately tied to the success of the oracle, which was a constant revenue stream for them. People had to pay their fee before they could consult. And as a result, this tiny town had an unbelievable sway over the Mediterranean world for such a long period of time.
Would you tell me briefly about the Big Dig? Because that in itself is an extraordinary yarn.
Yes. Delphi, after about the 7th century AD, disappears from our records. In fact, it disappeared entirely from view. It was buried under constant rock falls from the big cliffs of the Parnassian Mountains above. And it wasn't really until the 18th century that people realized where it was. And at that point, it was buried deep underneath a modern shanty town, if you like, the town of Castries. And in the 19th century, which is when archaeology really developed and got going, particularly archaeology in Greece got going, the different European nations who had decided that ancient Greece was an incredibly important culture for them and their history, they wanted to pour money into excavating sites. So the Germans were the first to excavate the site of Olympia. The British were in there fighting. We got Sparta. The Americans were there. And the French got Delphi alongside a number of others. And in the 1890s, after a 10-year battle to secure the rights to excavate the site, they began. And it was an extraordinary technical as well as financial task. They poured the equivalent of hundreds of millions of pounds into excavating, moving the modern settlement, building them a whole new town, and then excavating the sanctuary. But what they found was extraordinary. I mean, the tale every year of excavation, amazing pieces of sculpture, beautiful architecture, extraordinary finds were coming out of the ground, and they were being beamed around the world. One example for you, on the side of the treasury of the Athenians, they found musical notation. The first, if you like, real example of what music sounded like in the ancient world. And within, that was found in one summer, By the end of that year, by the winter, it was being played in St. Petersburg, London, Paris, down in South Africa, and it was being beamed around the world.
Delphi, A History of the Centre of the Ancient World by Michael Scott, is published by Princeton University Press. Coming up, The Great Gatsby with the great Sarah Churchill. When Scott Fitzgerald's masterpiece and everyone's favourite novel, The Great Gatsby, was released in 1925, initial reviews were lacklustre, well, to say the least. Words like melodramatic and superficial were deployed. As you know, set in the exclusive West Egg, which was really Great Neck on Long Island, Gatsby accurately reflected the mood of an era, the post-war, pre-Great Depression period of wild partying by the smart set of New York's jazz age, a term coined by Scott. And so he and his colourful wife, colourful being a well-chosen word, Zelda, were a central part of this culture. And ironically, this drinking, dancing, gambling, bootlegging all took place during the era of Prohibition. Well, inevitably. However, Sarah, my next guest, argues that in The Great Gatsby, F. Scott Fitzgerald managed to grasp what others could not or would not see. He sensed that America was poised at the edge of great transformation, a period of turmoil and decline. And as I was listening for the umpteenth time to my audio book of the novel, as I hurtled through the darkness last night, I marvelled yet again at his amazing sort of insights into human character and motivation. And beyond that, a sense of, if you like, of physical or political context that's hinted at in a way that not even Jane Austen managed to do. Now, Sarah Churchill, is Professor of American Literature and Public Understanding of the Humanities at the University of East Anglia, a fascinating name for a chair, and as Peter pointed out, she's also a 2014 Man Booker Prize judge, and she's written a wonderful biography of the book. And it's called, as we've already explained to you, Careless People, Murder, Mayhem, and the Invention of the Great Gatsby. And we welcome you to our little wireless program, Sarah.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be on the wireless.
Now, before the reviews came out, he confided to his editor that his book was about the best American novel ever written. Some of his friends might have disputed that, but he was on the money, I think.
I do too.
Why was he so confident?
Well, I think that he one of the things I talk about in the book was that he had an extraordinary intuition. He talked about it, particularly later in life, that his ability to guess right. And he had that intuition about his own work as well. And he just knew that he had done something that had never been done before, that he had captured a moment, but that he had done it in language that was timeless, and that he had written something extraordinary and beautiful, and yet that was full of insights and prescience, and that he had grabbed hold of something, and he just knew that he had, and he always had that confidence, even though, as you said, the novel was not particularly well reviewed when it came out. But he continued throughout his life to have faith, a Gatsby-esque faith, if you like, in the grandeur of what he had done. He wrote to his daughter just before he died in 1940 that it was a magnificent novel. So he always knew that, but nobody else around him seemed to see it.
It's interesting you talk about the longevity of the book, because Hemingway, his sort of friend, hasn't lasted as well as Fitzgerald, I think.
No, I agree. Although I think that it's also interesting that there are kind of trends and fashions, aren't there, in what we find interesting. And I, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, people were focusing on Hemingway and less interested in Fitzgerald. So these things are probably swings and roundabouts to a certain extent, and Hemingway may well yet, you know, live to live another day.
I've been pushing the barrow of another member of the triumvirate in Dos Passos. Happen to think USA is the great American novel, but he's
I'm actually with you on that.
Taste.
Well, and Dos Passos is, of course, an important part of my story. I mean, he was a friend of Fitzgerald's. He was, and of Hemingway's. And as you say, he's perhaps the less known of the three now. But I quite agree with you. And Steinbeck owes an awful lot to Dos Passos, USA trilogy and Grapes of Wrath. And he's credited with innovating things that actually Dos Passos was the one who innovated. So I'm quite with you on that.
I'm very unhappy and have been very unhappy about the movie versions. Most recently, Baz Luhrmann, who's a young Australian, as you know. And I was one of, there's a wonderful moment in the novel where on his Baz's depictions of these orgies, which would have made Rome embarrassed, versus that sheet of text where Scott Fitzgerald writes the names of the people who attend the parties, and he can put them all on one sheet of paper. It reminds us how, in a way, the book has become ever inflated by interpretation.
Absolutely, and how it's become kind of literalized by interpretation as well. I mean, I agree with you that, on the one hand, the parties in the Luhrmann film are sort of absurdly over the top. On the other hand, I find them strangely orchestrated. It's as if you're watching a show, you know, it's like he's directing. And they would have been much more chaotic and spontaneous than that. And that's something that I think Fitzgerald captures in his language as well, that this all of his parties, Gatsby's parties, are written about. The language that Fitzgerald uses is all implication, insinuation, hinting, suggestiveness. It is a profoundly suggestive novel. And Luhrmann, as is the case with other film and visual adaptations, seems to want to pin that down and reduce it and fix it to mean, you know, one thing or the other. I mean,
if ever there's a case of less is more, is The Great Gatsby as a novel.
Indeed. And, you know, I think we can all agree that that's probably not Luhrmann's long suit. It's not what he wants to do. I mean, he likes more is more, and that's fair enough. But it's not necessarily sympathetic to Fitzgerald's vision. And I think the other thing that's important for me about Luhrmann's vision of the party scenes is that he wants to celebrate them. And what that means to me is that actually the film that he produced is, I think, the film that Jay Gatsby would have made of his own life, but it's not the film that Scott Fitzgerald would have made. In other words, it doesn't have the darkness and the satire. Fitzgerald thought the parties were vulgar, and it's only the film adaptations progressively that have seen them as kind of purely romantic, but they weren't purely romantic in Fitzgerald's novel. They are a strange mix of romance and tawdriness. Luhrmann just seems to want to glamorize them, in my opinion.
You jolt me back into an awareness that 1922 was a period before traffic lights, before commercial radio, and in a sense, before the popular singer. You know, New York was still lit mainly by gaslight.
Absolutely. And that's, of course, why there are ash heaps. The ash heaps come, not gaslight, but coal fires. The ash heaps come between Long Island and Manhattan because they're the ashes from coal, which is what is primarily heating American homes. So we're really in a transitional state from the Edwardian era to the modern era. And that's something that we have lost sight of. A lot of our images of Gatsby come actually from the late 1920s, things that happened after Fitzgerald published the novel, things that he hadn't even seen or imagined. For example, two quick examples that I talk about in my book. One is that we all picture the flappers in those quintessential flapper dresses that are knee length and therefore daring and you know, racy. But dresses in 1922 in America, as in England actually, were nearly ankle length. They were much closer to the length of 1918 than to the length of 1928. In other words, it's a more conservative and older era. And the other great image, iconic image that we all have of Gatsby is of all the guests dancing the Charleston. But the Charleston wasn't a dance craze until after the novel was published. And the word never appears in the novel for that very reason. Fitzgerald almost certainly had never heard of it or seen it.
Let's go back to the traffic lights because I was convulsed with laughter on learning that the first traffic lights were not clearly understood. What did the green glass mean? So people would run reds and stop at green.
Well, I mean, that was one of the great... I'm glad you were convulsed with laughter because I was as well when I found it. What I wanted to do was to try to ascertain whether of all the meanings of the green light. And of course, you know, I teach American literature. I myself as a student, you know, people sit around in seminars and debate the meaning of the green light. It's one of the most famous symbols in American literature. Does it mean envy? Does it mean spring? Does it mean rebirth? Does it mean the color of money, which of course it means in America? And I would say it means all of those things. But one of the things I wanted then to find out was, could it have meant in Fitzgerald's mind, permission to go in the green light, you know, the traffic sense? And in order to know that, I just had to know whether that was a meaning that was available culturally at the time or whether we were anachronistically superimposing that back on it. And so I had to do a fair amount of research actually to find it. And it turns out, much to my delight, that New Yorkers were debating the meanings of green lights as Fitzgerald was writing the novel, just like all of us in our seminar classes, because they created these traffic lights, but they didn't have what they came to call traffic signal uniformity. In other words, they didn't use the lights consistently. So in some places, green seemed to mean stop, and in some places, green seemed to mean go, and red seemed to mean, you know, pause.
Free market forces.
Exactly. Like individualism.
Yeah. Well, one of the other things you do, which I think is a great help, is you reveal all the new terms that emerged. So we've got brand name, Hollywood, movie going, rough cut, robot, schlep, dimwit, multi-layered, mass market, transvestite, libidinal, post-Freudian, party crashing. Hello?
Yeah, sorry, just lost me there for a second. Yeah, I got you to party crashing. And then
I love all these terms. Yeah, at a time when America is being electrified, as you point out, there's an explosion of language.
Absolutely, and Virginia Woolf has a great observation about that, where she says that Americans in the early 1920s are doing what the Elizabethans did, that they're coining new language. And she says it doesn't take much to see that when you're coining new language, a new literature will emerge from it. One of the things that struck me about those words, I have a kind of long list of the words that emerged between 1928 and 1923, the period over which the action of Gatsby takes place. And one of the things that struck me also was how modern that language was. A lot of words that I thought were recent coinages are actually from the early 1920s. So the word post-feminist is first used in 1919, amazingly to me. The word subprime, I mean, I was writing this book as our crash was happening around us, and the word subprime was first used then as well. The words like wimp and cool first being used as a term of approval, and indeed wicked being used as a term of approval, and party being used as a verb. So I found it really amusing to think, you know, if you said, "We partied last night and it was wicked," I think most of us would think that was 90s slang. But actually, you could have said that in the 1920s.
Now, one of the things that emerges from your researches is that again and again, Scott Fitzgerald is doing rip and tear. There's another term, piece of terminology. He's taking things from the newspapers. He's taking events and transmogrifying them, turning them into literature. Tell us about some of the things that were actually going on that might have been inspirational.
I mean, there was a great deal. I started to read through the papers because, as the example of the green light shows, what I was trying to do was to understand, was to try to remove the layers of anachronism and myth and misconception that have accrued about the novel over time, and to go back to what meanings would have been available to Fitzgerald and his contemporaries to remember that it was a contemporary novel. And to do that, I went back to first principles and started reading newspapers and magazines to try to forget everything that I knew after 1925 and to only think about what he would have known when he was writing the novel. So I was doing it first in a spirit of research, and then, to my amazement, I kept turning up these details that echoed and corresponded with the novel itself, and came to feel that he was actually kind of, as you say, he was sort of transmuting and translating all of these contemporary details around him into the story. The one of the most interesting, which is the one that I spend the most time on in the book, for my money, was a real-life murder mystery that happened at the end of 1922, which of course is also the year in which Gatsby is set. And a minister and his lover were found murdered in a field in New Jersey, and it became headline news very quickly for lots of reasons. And a lot of the details in that case kind of find their way into Gatsby. And in particular, I came to feel that the female victim in the case was a dead ringer for Myrtle Wilson, and that her husband was even more of a dead ringer for George Wilson, Myrtle's husband. Fitzgerald uses language to describe George Wilson in The Great Gatsby that is almost verbatim the language that the newspapers used to describe the victim's husband, who was a man named James Mills. And I gave that story a fair amount of prominence in my book for a couple of reasons. I ended up, you said that it was as I say, my book is a kind of biography of Gatsby. But as I wrote it, it also became, I realized it was becoming a kind of nonfiction parallel to it, a kind of nonfiction version of it. And so I used Hall Mills, the murder is called the Hall Mills murder, and I used it as a kind of parallel version of the Tom and Myrtle story, but one that was historically true. So Fitzgerald gives about 20% of Gatsby to the Tom and Myrtle story, so I gave about 20% of my book to the Hall Mills story, but I also did that because I thought it was a story that was amazing in its own right. I mean, it is macabre and hilarious in a sort of grotesque and awful way, in a kind of farcical, dark, you know, black comedy. And so I thought it was sort of an amazing story. But what I thought it also did was point up the darkness and the chaos of life in America in the early 1920s, because, as we said a moment ago, we have tended very much to romanticize and glamorize the era, but it was a dark and a brutal era as well, and that is part of what Gatsby is about. It's a darker novel than we tend to remember, I think, a tawdrier novel, and it's a novel about tawdriness. It's not itself tawdry, but it's creating a tawdry reality. And that for me was what this murder kind of, I hoped it would remind people of that or bring it back to life.
Well, I think the clumsy interpretations of the novel that were particularly cinematic ones, can be extrapolated into that terrible, I think, Scorsese film, The Wolf of Wall Street, which has no sort of moral center at all. It just sort of wallows in what it ostensibly criticizing. Whereas what Scott Fitzgerald is doing all the time is being, in fact, almost godlike, you know, looking down on these people, not with cruel judgment and with a fair degree of compassion, but with a high sense of morality. It is a very moral book.
Absolutely. He was a moralist, and he would be delighted to hear you say that. I think he would have been horrified at anybody not seeing that this is, as you say, a novel with a very clear moral center. And the you mentioned that he kind of stands in judgment, and of course it is and I agree with that, and of course it's a novel in which it opens with Nick Carraway eschewing judgment, claiming that he reserves all judgment. And one way of reading the novel would be to say that it is the story of Nick Carraway's lesson that judgments must be made, that we can't go through life not making judgments, that we have to make certain kinds of distinctions and moral distinctions, and that these are incredibly important. And I agree with you. I think the way that Scorsese was enjoying what the film kind of pretended to criticize is, again, you know, kind of takes us back to Lerman, that what is great about the novel is the way in which it is ambiguous, but it's about ambivalence. It's about the fact that we crave beauty and luxury, and yet Fitzgerald recognized that was corrupt, that is a corrupt desire and would corrupt us. Yeah.
We've talked about our shared interest in Dos Passos and Hemingway, but as we talk, I suddenly think more and more that the book that it most reminds me of is Pride and Prejudice of Jane Austen, you know, where she's, because both writers see the people with such total and absolute clarity and have towards them a sort of, it is that she's both are judgmental, but both are also, in a way, the most delicious satirists.
Absolutely. It is such a satirical novel, and I think you're absolutely, it is a social satire. And to go back to the point that you made when we started about the degree to which its contemporary readers didn't appreciate it, part of that was because it was so clearly for them a contemporary satire that was all they could see. And so they thought that it would date instantly. They thought that it was just a story of the summer because it was satirizing their world so clearly and so sharply. They also thought that because until Gadsby, Fitzgerald was primarily known as a satirist. He is a much funnier writer than we think, again, because of that image of romance and glamour that we have. It tends to overwrite. I'm not saying that he's not a romantic and glamorous writer, but rather that that tends to overwrite everything else that he also is. And I just would say about the Jane Austen comparison, I think you're absolutely right. It's one I've made myself. And I think that where, you know, Austen famously writes comedies of manners, I would just say that Gatsby is a tragedy of manners.
Yeah.
You know, it's about the tragic consequences of that world, but he absolutely has an Austenian sense of the hilarities of it as well.
Well, both of us would reject Hemingway's swipe at him in the Snows of Kilimanjaro, referring to him as poor Scott Fitzgerald, pathetically defined by his romantic awe of the rich. I don't see romantic awe of the rich for a moment.
No, not at all. It's an excoriation of the rich. He calls them careless. And that's where the title of my book comes from. He says, Tom and Daisy were careless people and they destroy lives and then they walk away. There is no romantic awe of the rich there. It is a novel in which the rich are the bad guys, or the, you know, old money, are the bad guys. And Fitzgerald was very, very angry at Hemingway for saying that. In fact, he wrote Hemingway a very sharp letter saying, I have never been fascinated by mere wealth. I am only fascinated by interesting people, and some of them, you know, they may have the trappings of wealth, or wealth may enable them to do things. He did studies of what wealth did to people. The next major work that he wrote after The Great Gatsby is a story called The Rich Boy, which is where Hemingway gets that quotation from, where he says that the rich are different from you and me. But Fitzgerald in The Rich Boy is writing a study of the corrupting power of wealth. It is about how growing up rich destroys you. So what he's saying is he says the rich are different because they have grown up under different circumstances. He's making a socially anthropological observation, which I think is true. The other thing about that Hemingway story that briefly is worth saying, because it's an urban myth that has made the rounds. People think that line from Kilimanjaro was Hemingway's riposte to Fitzgerald. The only thing that's different about the rich is that they have more money. But in fact, in point of historical fact, it was Hemingway who, at a dinner at which Scott Fitzgerald was not even present, said, I'm getting to know the rich. And an Irish writer and critic named Mary Colum said to Hemingway, the rich are no different from you and me, they only have more money. Hmm. Hemingway took that line that had been used to shoot him down and humiliate him in public and used it against Scott Fitzgerald, who hadn't even been present at the time in his story. So I always try to defend Scott when that story comes up.
Sarah, how did he handle money himself? Now, his career has some extraordinary ups and downs, but in due course, he becomes a very successful, financially successful writer. Does he handle it well, or is he...
Yeah, having just said that I'll defend Scott, I think it would be foolish to try to defend his business sense. He and Zelda were both very profligate. He did earn very well, particularly at the beginning of his career, for the 20s, from 1920 when he broke out with his first novel, This Side of Paradise, through 1929 and 1930, through the crash, basically. He was one of America's highest paid writers, and he made a great deal of money, and they ran through it almost instantly. They lived very much beyond their means. That said, they were also very young. I mean, we mentioned at the beginning that Zelda was born in 1900. In other words, when they got married and started partying, she was only 20 years old, and he was 24. And I think it's fair to say that, you know, I know a fair number of 20 and 24-year-olds who aren't great with money either, especially if they get an awful lot of it. Once the crash happened, Fitzgerald's literary fortunes took a very sudden nosedive, and for the last decade of his life, he actually didn't have very much money at all. He was in debt, and Zelda was ill, as I'm sure your listeners know. She had a very serious mental breakdown, and so he had to pay for her hospitalization costs. He wanted her to have, obviously, the finest medical care, and for their daughter's education, because with all the difficulties they were both having, they sent their daughter to boarding school and then to university. And suddenly he found himself not able to pay for those kinds of necessities, although granted, as I say, he wanted the finest of those necessities, but he was really struggling for the last decade to even make ends meet, and he died more or less a pauper, I mean, you know, in real terms.
With, as I recall, a rather poorly attended funeral.
It was. He had, again, one of these moments of uncanny prescience. His funeral echoed Jay Gatsby's funeral, which he had imagined 15 years earlier, to a really extraordinary degree. It was raining and there were only kind of 20 people there, 20 or 30 people. Zelda wasn't able to come because her doctors judged that it would have been too dangerous for her. She had a breakdown when she heard the news. And Fitzgerald's daughter later told the story, which hasn't been much reported and which I found absolutely astonishing, that Scott Fitzgerald was Catholic, but he wasn't, he didn't die, he was a lapsed Catholic, and so he wasn't buried in a Catholic burial. He had an Episcopal minister. And this Episcopal minister took the extraordinary decision, in his, during the funeral service, to say that Fitzgerald was a no good drunken bum, and that the only reason he'd agreed to take on the service was because he wanted to put him in the ground. I mean, and you can't imagine anybody saying such a thing. I mean, yeah. It's just extraordinary. And I found it amazing that story didn't get more traction, because that seems to me one of the more, outrageous things I've ever heard in my life.
You tell me that post-feminist is a term from the 20s. Can we now, as we wind up, can I ask you, how well do you think you wrote Daisy?
That's a good question. I think that Daisy is, I think he wrote her very well in technically, in the sense that what he wanted, as with Gatsby, was he wanted somebody who was an idea more than a person. And so, in fact, all the characters, except for Nick, you could say that about. They're gestures. Daisy is a low voice, and she's just got this magical voice. She has hair that is different colors at different times in the book. Sometimes it's yellow, sometimes it's dark. And she's a symbol. And she's a symbol of what Gatsby desires. She's a symbol of wealth. She's a symbol of inclusiveness, of, being, getting it right and being in the in crowd and all of the things that Gatsby desires. Some people have faulted Fitzgerald for writing a female character who was only a symbol. But, of course, she's also a symbol to Gatsby. I mean, we can say that that's Gatsby's failure rather than Fitzgerald's, that he never sees her as a human being. He certainly can't see her flaws. So what I would say is that Fitzgerald very accurately captures the way, the power structures of sexual politics in the early 1920s, and we can debate whether and to what degree he was able to escape those himself.
It's lovely to talk to someone who shares not only my enthusiasm, but I'm sure that of a great many of your listeners here, because, as I said, it's almost everyone's favourite novel. You've done it proud, Sarah. Sarah Churchwell, author of Careless People, Murder, Mayhem, and the Invention of the Great Gatsby, published by Virago Books. Sarah, thank you. On our next, the story of the enigmatic super spy, and come closer because I've got to whisper this because it is pretty secret, Kim Philby, and the discovery of the notorious Guatemalan secret police archive documenting years of state-sponsored genocide. Stick around now for the news on RN, and I'll talk to you again shortly.